From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Today, just for you, we go to a primo spot in the Berkshires to get a little spice in our Shakespeare.
This is true.
Just do it one more time. The erotic was in there, but can you up the erotic, please?
Sure.
Shakespeare and Company celebrates four decades of drama on, and I really should say off, the stage. We'll explain in a bit. Also, our summer fiction series continues with, well, not so much fiction, but poetry, inspired by nature, the beautiful and the battered.
I arrived home one afternoon on my bicycle, and crawling across the drive in front of me was this tiny little brown-winged creature. I nearly hit it.
And our commentator this week heard all sorts of people tell him downtown Springfield was no place to raise kids. He blew off that advice and says he definitely made the right choice.
They know what poverty is. They understand not everyone's been given the opportunities they've been given. They seek out diversity.
All that just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, one school district for all 15,000 of Berkshire County's school children. That's what an advisory panel of educators, local officials, and business leaders is recommending. They commissioned a new study that says this approach could solve a lot of the problems the schools are facing. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier reports.
The study says the county as a whole could save tens of millions of dollars each year by banding together. John Hockridge is the chair of the Berkshire Education Task Force and is a member of the North Adams School Committee. He says much of the discussion by the group recently had centered around the upside of dividing the Berkshires into three districts, but it became clear.
Doing it at a county level just took all of those advantages and expanded upon them. It just provided more opportunities for academic programming, more ability to provide expertise, shared staffing and shared services.
At the root of financial problems many Berkshire districts face is the county's dwindling population and, in turn, school enrollment. State funding formulas are largely based on how many students a district has. Add in rising employee benefit costs, and many places have had to lay off staff and offer fewer classes. And many warn the current model, 19 districts for 32 communities, won't work much longer. Carrie Green is a task force member from the Mount Greylock District. She says the group approach is needed right now.
The more we can support education across the county and offer programming to our students that may not be available in an individual school because of the strains fiscally and administratively on that school system, the better off we all are.
Any final decisions on consolidation will be up to the individual cities and towns. The idea of some local governments giving up control of their schools will be a sticking point. And Pittsfield School Superintendent Jason McCandless admits the whole concept could be a hard sell, but he says it's worth talking about.
It's really up to 32 different communities to join together in some way and have the conversation about, hey, this is out here. It's not impossible. We could do it.
The task force's next step is talking with school committee members and town officials around the Berkshires. And any move toward a single district could be a decade away. For New England Public Radio, I'm Adam Frenier.
All right, let's stay in Massachusetts' westernmost county for a few more minutes. With summer in full swing, one of the nation's largest Shakespeare festivals is celebrating a big anniversary this year. Reporter Rebecca Shear takes us to Lenox for the story of Shakespeare and Company's four decades of dramatics on and off stage.
In a 400-plus seat theater near downtown Lenox, actors are rehearsing one of the last and least known of William Shakespeare's 37 plays, Cymbeline.
So bravely done, so rich, that it did strive in workmanship and value.
This is true.
Just do it one more time. The erotic was in there, but can you up the erotic, please?
Sure.
The director requesting more erotic is Tina Packer. She's the namesake of this theater, the Tina Packer Playhouse. It's her first time directing Cymbeline, and now that she has...
I have worked my way through the whole canon, and some of them, like Midsummer Night's Dream, I've probably done 8 times in my life.
The first was in 1978, the year Packer founded Shakespeare and Company. It was the troupe's inaugural play, and they performed it at The Mount, Edith Wharton's estate and the company's original home. Packer says they threw it together in 10 days.
But it was an enormous success in the community, so we extended its run, and we had a terrific time, and that's how we began.
As for how the whole idea of Shakespeare and Company began, well, we have to go back to Packer's native England, where she was an actor in film, television.
Including the one that follows me everywhere still, which is Doctor Who.
But mostly theater.
And I had ideas about what I thought theater was about.
Especially Shakespeare.
I knew every time I did a Shakespeare play, I'm talking about as an actor now, I would grow exponentially through what I would see that I hadn't seen before, about humanity, about political structures, about the way we interact with each other.
So she decided to tackle the Bard as a director.
So that I could have power to do what I wanted to do in the theatre. And I made the switch very quickly. Actually, I walked out of the television I was doing.
Fast forward to 1978. Packer nabbed a grant in the U.S. and started her company. Not in a thriving theater hub like New York or London, but in the Berkshires.
I wanted to see, can a classical theater company have an effect on a community? You know, in New York or London, you can't tell what impact you're having on the community. So I wanted an identifiable community.
The troupe took up residence at the Mount, and current artistic director Ellen Burroughs, who joined the company as an actor in 1989, fondly recalls performing all over the estate, in the house, the stables, and outdoors, in the main stage theater.
Basically, you had the largest usable outdoor space in the country. It was 100 yards wide. We could bring horses up onto the stage and trucks. I remember doing Taming of the Shrew and we couldn't get the pickup truck to start in a downpour.
And then on clearer nights,
in front of an audience of about 700 people, you would have the moon rising up above the pines while Shakespearean text was being delivered in total silence.
But Shakespeare and Company didn't just perform Shakespeare. They started a training program for actors and an education program for schools. Kevin Coleman developed the latter.
One little girl in a workshop, it was a 45-minute workshop, and she was playing Ophelia. And at the end of that workshop, she said, "I've learned more about Ophelia in 45 minutes than I have the last 4 weeks we've been reading it in the classroom."
During Shakespeare and Company's earliest years, they performed 2 or 3 plays a season. By the 1990s, it was more than a dozen. But with this growth came growing pains. Ellen Burroughs says funds were so tight in the late 90s, they did what Shakespeare's troupe did and had actors handle the administrative work, from publicity to the box office. Burroughs started a pub.
Which, you know, largely meant that the actors' paychecks could be circulated back through the pub.
Once they were in the black, they hired staff to take over. But it wasn't long before another challenge arose. Major tensions between the theater company and the nonprofit that owned the Mount.
And in any tenant-landlord situation, there are going to be different priorities, different visions, different agendas.
After a drawn-out legal battle, Shakespeare and Company relocated to the sprawling 30-acre campus that once housed the Lenox School for Boys.
So then we built a theater out of their gymnasium.
They built another theater out of their hockey rink.
And their dorms became our apartments.
That was in 2001. Just as before, the company kept performing on stage, training actors, and teaching Shakespeare in schools. But behind the scenes, the drama continued. At one point, the company created a new position, executive director.
Basically, when the executive director was brought in, there's a culture here that he maybe didn't understand. And then there were miscommunications. And when misunderstandings are accelerated, then they can become very acute.
So acute that what happened next was straight out of a Shakespeare play. An artistic director was ousted. The executive director resigned. Turnover and turmoil swept the company's board. After a pair of interim artistic directors steered things for a spell, Burroughs was hired in 2016.
When I came in, stability was a real priority. Making sure that everyone was heard, making sure we put ourselves on a firm financial footing, and now we're going to kind of steady the ship.
Burroughs plans to add more American classics to Shakespeare and Company's repertoire, to foster new work through playwriting workshops, and to bring company productions to New York, the very place Tina Packer avoided back in 1978.
Had you decided to do it in a big city, do you think the company would have lasted this long?
I don't think it would have. Let's just say we'd have done it in New York. We would never have been able to have the leeway to make the mistakes we did.
Instead, they now have nearly 200 people on staff. More than 10,000 actors have gone through the training program. More than 1 million students have done the education program.
So can a classical theater company affect a community? The answer is yes. You know, we're not just teaching the kids of the kids now. We're teaching the kids of the kids of the kids.
And performing for them, too. Nowadays, nearly 33,000 patrons flock to Shakespeare and Company's plays each season to experience the Bard in the Berkshires. For New England Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Shear.
All right, we are going to continue our summer fiction series now with a form of literature that, granted, is not strictly made up. Nyla Marrera is a science and environmental journalist who also writes poems. Her new book of poetry is immersed in the natural world. She wrote it while living alone in a farmhouse apartment on the Mill River in Leeds, Massachusetts. In a conversation with New England Public Radio's Karen Brown, Marrera starts by reading the title poem of her book named Water Street, after the road she lived on.
A fragrance fills the garden, making me forget everything. It smells like oleander and pollen. It smells like the asphodel, like Circe's garden. To live here, I left my husband. I left the world. The scent floats over the waterfall that endlessly washes the earth clean. My brothers are wasps and spiders, the mink that lives under the stones. Shapeshifter, weaver, master of two realms. Here I have no children, only poems.
So that's a real nice scene setting for us. And my sense is that this is a somewhat literal description of where you were when you were writing these poems?
Yes, that's right. The apartment was next to a smallish waterfall on the Mill River. And the interesting thing about that waterfall was that at certain levels of the water, it would pound. It would hit a resonant frequency. And so that pounding was sort of a part of my days.
Now, you clearly are a nature lover. And one of your other probably many jobs is writing environmental columns for mm-hmm. the local newspaper. Mm-hmm. And is it fair to say that you are a climate advocate or
yes.
a climate science advocate? So how does your poetry fit into your advocacy around mm-hmm. environmentalism?
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. I don't use poetry explicitly to advocate. I think that there can be an artificiality that's introduced or a didacticism that doesn't fit the kind of the bounds of what a good poem is. Some poets are able to do it really excellently. I have never been able to, but I do think that when you deeply care about something, it comes through in any kind of artistic work that you do. And so I wind up writing a lot about my fears for nature, for the environment, for the future that we expect to see with climate change. And it just comes through every time I see a little change in the environment around me that kind of ripples into the poetry.
Now, there is one poem in here that seems to be rather explicitly, I don't know if political is the right word, but you have a poem about bats and uh-huh. you include a little note at the end about how they are really being threatened right now.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and that poem, absolutely, that was a moment where the larger ecological threat really crashed up against my life in a very basic way, where I arrived home one afternoon on my bicycle, and crawling across the drive in front of me was this tiny little brown-winged creature. I nearly hit it. But I jumped off my bicycle. Here's this bat looking absolutely miserable, crawling on the ground where they don't belong. And I gathered it up and tried to save it, and a poem came out of that because it was a very striking and kind of painful experience in some ways.
How much of this book of poetry is metaphorical and how much is descriptive. And obviously you don't have a percentage, but, you know, it seems like there's a combination of those two things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think for me the Holy Grail of poetry is a poem that you can read on a literal level and that makes sense and that you don't need to analyze, but that as you look further into the poem, the metaphors, the symbols, the abstract thinking gradually rises up, like arriving at a marsh, and you see the marsh, and gradually as you wait longer and longer, you see more and more, you see the dragonfly, you see the muskrat coming up out of the deep, you know, you a great blue heron alights in the center of the pond. So I think a great poem does exactly that, where if you wait, if you linger, if you look at the words, it's like a pond and things gradually surface.
Nyla Marrera's new poetry collection is called Water Street, and you can find more selections from our summer fiction series at NEPR.net. After living both in the Mountain West and Europe, commentator Steve Schultes settled in his native Springfield. Out west, Schultes says, he observed a sprawling, car-dependent way of life. He far preferred Europe's walkable, bikeable cities. So he and his then-wife put down stakes in Springfield's downtown. He's had no regrets.
Downtown was a great place to live and work. No one batted an eye about our decision until our oldest daughter was about to turn kindergarten age. Then the questions started. When are you putting your unit up for sale? Where are you moving? We had bought close enough to the bottom of the market that we could still have gotten out, and with some extra cash as well. But we stayed. Kindergarten was great. First grade, too. Soon both girls were going to Milton Bradley Elementary. My mom was volunteering at the school library. My wife became president of the PTO. I joined the school center decision-making team. The principal made sure she knew every kid's name within 2 weeks, and there were hundreds. She lived for that school and filled us with confidence in it. The girls made lots of friends and lots of academic progress, too. Our eldest, by fourth grade, tested his reading at the college level. The school noticed our second grader was off to a slower start and got her the extra help she needed. She's been a strong reader ever since. Middle school, though. Now we heard, you can't have your girls in school with those boys. The principal of Forest Park had been my PE teacher. Smart, no-nonsense, dedicated. With Miss Fazio at the helm, there could be no better place for my daughters. On to high school. Our divorce gave my girls the chance to opt out of the city altogether, but they both chose commerce in Springfield with its international baccalaureate program. They played soccer and were captains. They played basketball and sat the bench. Both good lessons. By graduation, they'd each earned generous academic scholarships to college. Today, neither has or wants a driver's license. They know what poverty is. They understand not everyone's been given the opportunities they've been given. They seek out diversity. Growing up in Springfield is an experience they wouldn't change for the world. In fact, in many ways, it's the experience that opened up the world to them.
Steve Schultes lives in Springfield and teaches in Suffield, Connecticut. He also writes a blog. It's called Rational Urbanism. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and a news guy who also hosts a music show. That's Kari Njiri, a star, no doubt. Check out Jazz Safari on Saturday nights on WFCR or anytime at NEPR.net. And wouldn't you know it, that just so happens to be the same web address you can go to support New England Public Radio. Just click the orange donate button at the top of the screen. All right, thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really should not miss. You can subscribe to any of NEPR's awesome and varied podcast offerings wherever you get your podcasts or at NEPR.net/podcast. Until next time.